Tonight on Arena. Playwright Mari Jones on a new production of Stones in His Pockets. We look back at 75 years of Sunset Boulevard and review a new opera, the Galway International Arts Festival. It's 51551 to contact us tonight by text, and we're also on Twitter and on Instagram as well. Let's get started. Belfast writer Mari Jones has been a playwright since her early days as an actor in the 1980s, but she's probably best known for Stones in His Pockets and its comic take on the actor's life and the ways of Tinseltown. It's the tale of two locals, Charlie and Jake, working as extras in a Hollywood film being shot in their small town in Kerry. It's everywhere today. Stones in His Pockets became a worldwide phenomenon after its premiere in Belfast in 1999. It won Olivier Awards in London, was nominated for Tony Awards on Broadway, and has played in almost 40 countries. Mari's husband, actor Ian McElhenney, directed Conleth Hill and Sean Campion in the original production, and now their son Matthew McElhenney directs a new production at the Everyman in Cork, starring Jared McCabe and Sean Blaney, and it opens this Wednesday. I'm delighted that Mari Joan joins me now from Greece for pleasure, I presume, Mari?
Oh, yes, of course, yes, on holiday. Yamas. Of course.
Well, thanks for taking the time out to talk to us this evening.
no bother.
Kerry seems to be the place today. There's some sort of sporting event happened over the weekend. I haven't really heard very much about it. But tell us a little bit about where we start, about Charlie and about Jake and the Kerry set that they then find themselves on.
Well, at the time when I wrote the play, there were big Hollywood movies being made in Ireland. I suppose it's the take on The Quiet Man, really, when you bring a big sort of like the circus of Hollywood into a small rural town. That was happening a lot at that time. And I suppose the idea came from, I've been an extra myself on a movie and having a great bit of crack, you know, with the extras and thinking, I think this, what would it be like, you know, to turn this whole thing around and tell the story like they saw it, that they the Ireland of the story that they know. And I think it came from that. I mean, the seed was sort of like set then, and then over time, you know, my husband Dan has been in movies and just watched it, and I thought everybody's fascinated by the movie. So what about like turning us on its head and making the extras actually in the theatre the stars of the play about the movie? So it kind of came from that, and then it just snowballed. I think probably, you know, because theatre, because you never have any money, everybody's looking for funding. And the fact it was attractive in the first place, because there were only two actors telling a story with loads of other people in it. So from a producer's point of view, I thought, well, that's a good one, before they knew anything about it. And I think also because the actors tell the story of every single person in the movie, and they play all the parts. And that's the magic of theatre. You wouldn't get that in cinema. You would have every actor playing every part, because it's not acceptable. But in theatre, it's totally magic, because you can just turn around with the flick of an earring, the flick of a shoulder, and become a different person. I think it's probably a part of the attraction of the play as well.
I'm going to play a little clip from the play here. This is Charlie and Jake, and they're getting their eyes opened as to how Hollywood views Ireland. They're talking about what they're being asked to do on set.
I haven't dug turf since I was a wee buck.
I haven't dug turf since... I'm not going to lie, I've never dug turf.
Yeah, it'll be a nice romantic rural Irish scene, eh?
Yes, I think it will be, you know, with Maeve coming over the hill on her horse and talking Rory coming over the hill on his horse and talking Maeve and saying, I'd give her one all right.
And all the while the fiddles playing along in the background.
Exactly, man. Yes, that's why I love the movies. Unreal, man.
It's not real, Charlie.
Is there a Jake Quinn here?
Yeah.
Ashton, come in. Yeah, Clem doesn't like the cows. He says they're not Irish enough.
That is a clip from Stones in His Pockets. I want to go back maybe and scroll back ever so slightly. You were an actor first in the 1980s.
Yes.
Talk to me about when you decided you were going to write as well, and how that came about and why that came about.
Well, it came about because there wasn't a lot of work. At that time, when I was really sort of starting to get into professional acting, I was in my 30s, and there was a lot of other, not a lot, but there were four or five of us. And most of the leads were either much older people or else kind of much younger people. Like none of us were femme fatales, I can tell you that for a start. And also because they would be bringing, like, people just come out of drama school in England over to play Irish parts. So we're kind of getting a bit pissed off with that. And at the time, Martin Lynch, who's another playwright, had written a play about the Belfast docks, and it was on in the theatre. And we all went to see it and thought, that's the kind of theatre would be great for us to write as women about our history, our background, our mothers and fathers and what they did and what made Belfast was the linen industry, the ropes work industry and the shipyard. So we decided that given the linen industry was mainly a female preserve, we would start to look to find out, was there a story there? And then we realised every single one of us had a connection. You know, our mothers had all worked in the linen industry. And therefore, and then we found this little story about a strike, the first female strike ever in 1912. So we decided, let's get it together and try and find, we could write our own play. And we did it together, but as with Martin Lynch, but as you know, other skills emerge, and out of that, I think I probably became the one who enjoyed the storytelling the most, who enjoyed writing the most. And I mean, we all had our old skills, and so we kept that company. It was called Charabang. In fact, we played the Dublin Theatre Festival, and that play, because I don't think anybody had seen anything like it, because we did the same almost like a Stones now. We told the story, we played all the parts, but it was like kind of new thing then in theatre. And before you knew it, within like, I think not even a year of that, we ended up in the Soviet Union playing in Moscow, Leningrad and Vilnius through this company called a Friendship Society for Cultural Exchange. How the hell we ended up there, I do not know. But it kind of took off from there that we were doing something a wee bit different, a wee bit special. And then after a while, I emerged as probably the sole writer.
You make it sound almost easy, and I know it probably wasn't at that point, as a young playwright to get backing for a play and to get a play put on as part of a festival and to get something off the ground.
Do you know what? It wasn't easy, but we were so passionate and so determined, and we had great supporters here, there at home, and also in the Dublin Theatre Festival, people who really, really like supported us and wanted us to do well, our own union, our equity union, because we were trying to pay ourselves, and we also were very concerned we paid everybody properly, and equity would find us little legal loopholes for us so we could continue. So we had an immense amount of support from everybody around us. So we were able to go to the Dublin Theatre Festival, and then through that we were able to go get to Edinburgh. We do a lot of fundraising, and we would just a lot of begging and borrowing. And because we were passionate, it wasn't hard. It was like, what else are we going to do? And then when we got to Edinburgh, then people saw us. And then the next thing you know, we're touring the States with on our props. We're like in a wee tiny suitcase. But I think it was the passion and the belief and the fact that, you know, the storytelling was there. I mean, if you say it wasn't easy, it wasn't hard. We had the best of times, really. We did the best of times. It's much harder now to get the funding that we were able to get at the time. We were able to get it like an unemployment program, which they would not consider now as art being like, we weren't producing like a product, like, you know, like screws or nails or anything that you could tangibly hold in your hand. But our product was art, and we made them believe that that was something that they should support. So we had an employment program that paid us for about 2 years, but I'm talking about 35 years ago or more. Wouldn't happen now, but anyway, we got there in the end, and through just belief, sheer belief.
I'm interested that Sean spoke with your son Matthew McElhenney a few years ago when he was directing the production at the Lyric in Belfast for the 25th anniversary. When you were writing Stones in His Pockets initially, did you think that it would have this level of durability? And I know the answer is probably no, but how did you feel about it at the time?
Well, at the time, I just loved telling the story. But I remember that when Ian, who was the original director, going into the Lyric with the original actors, Conleth Hill and Sean Campy, and I remember coming back and he said, you know, I think there's something very, very, very special going on here. But, you know, this could be something that could be quite big. We didn't, I mean, it wasn't an overnight journey whatsoever, overnight success. I mean, we did do the Lyric, and then we went down to the down to Dublin. Pat Morland's company. Then we went to Edinburgh. Then we went to Tricycle, and it just gained traction. It was just snowballs. But the difference then was I was unknown, so was Conleth, so was Sean, and so was Ian. And yet we were able to go to the West End and go to Broadway on the strength of the play. That's not possible anymore, because you can't go to the West End now without a star, whereas none of us were stars then. It's just the industry has changed so much. So I think we were just very lucky then to be able to take, you know, that nobody said, well, you know, what film have you been in, or what have you done before? What's your track record? They took it on the reviews and the fact that the word of mouth, that the audience loved the play. But I would say anybody now would find that really hard to do unless they had a star. There's me giving out already.
but for anybody who's been to a play in the West End or on Broadway in the last few years, I mean, you can see that's a true story. Stones in His Pockets. I was going to ask you about it. It is one of those plays that actors love. It's a kind of, you know, a tour de force for them. I mean,
yes.
There's 15 characters between the actors, and they move in and out of them in the blink of an eye. Do you think that when you were writing those scenes, your own acting experience was what you drew on when you were putting that together, and you thought, I wouldn't mind playing that?
Yeah, well, we know actors are show-offs. Everybody knows that, you know. They love to be able to show that they can turn around and be a different character, you know. From their new age, you know, they're putting on voices and mimicking different people. So that, I mean, we don't have to worry about it. It's a brilliant skill to have, though, but it's the choreography of it is so crucial. It's really crucial. It's like, you know, with a literally big turn. There's one particular, the one particular scene is like a standout where the two actors play, I think, about eight different people, and all in one little kind of scene. And they're up, they're down, they're changed, they have a walking stick. And it's quite actually incredible. I mean, it took a while to get there, but when you see the choreography in it, it's like a dance. And the spread, that these are all new inventions. What's great about the Playwright also is that this new production, because we live in a different world now. When we did it, we had a backdrop of a lot of old shoes and a canvas. But now, because of technology, you know, we can actually, because it's about the film industry, we can actually show that film being made on stage with the actors. I mean, it doesn't take away from the narrative whatsoever or from their skills, but it's just nice to have that something. That's what makes it the new production. And you know, the irony is, you know, when the producers in West End say you have to have a star, the whole point of the play is it's about two nobodies who are not stars playing all the stars. So a great, well, I'm not getting away too much by the end of it, but when they do say at the very end, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could write our own story about Ireland when the stars become the extras and we become the stars. So very cleverly, Matthew and the producer, Ewan Lewis, went to all these well-known actors and said, can we green screen you? And you dress up a peasant and do an Irish dance. And they all did, and they appeared at the end with Liam Neeson, Kieran Hines, Sadie Dunbar, Jimmy Nesbitt, half the Derry Girls cast, all did it. Absolutely, without a question.
I want to ask you one final thing, and it's kind of, I suppose, an important question. I mean, Stones in His Pockets, it sends up that diddly eye Finian's rainbow treatment that Hollywood films gave Ireland for decades. Do you think that tendency of Hollywood to treat Ireland that way has changed in any way in the last, whatever, 25 years and counting since you wrote the play?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's changed because, you know, there are there were films being made by very well-known Irish writers and filmmakers. And I mean, I think Jim Sheridan led the way with that. So absolutely did. And many, many more, Conor McPherson. So no, it's not like that. But what doesn't change is the fact that the worlds are completely, completely different. You know, it's not the story now, but you know, it's still the circus coming into town, you know, all the caravans and the big stars and the extras and in small towns where the communities are completely different and their way of life is completely different. Then they leave and it's just back to the way it was before. So there's still that part of it that is real. And sometimes even the technology is different now because it would be, you know, being digital cameras. But I think the story still holds. Well, hopefully it does.
Mary Jones, firstly, thanks a million for taking time on your holiday in Greece to talk to us. Stones in His Pockets returns at the Everyman in Cork from tomorrow, the 29th of July till the 10th of August. And you'll find full details at everymancork.com. 75 years ago this week, a film was released which drew back the curtain on the glamorous world of Hollywood, revealing the hidden shadows. It was 1950, the film was Sunset Boulevard, and it immediately shook the Hollywood firmament and has stayed with us ever since. Made by the great Billy Wilder, it's the story of an aging actress called Norma Desmond, who was once a colossus of the silent era and is now living a reclusive life in her mansion. In a brilliant piece of casting, the role was played by an actress who herself at once bestrode the world of the silent screen, Gloria Swanson. Joining me now to remember the film is Stephen Benedict. We're going to begin with a clip which features a line that immediately gained immortality. This is the very first meeting between William Holden, playing Joe Gillis, and Gloria Swanson as Norma Desmond.
Wait a minute, haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures, used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
And for so many people who may not necessarily have seen the film, they will know that line, Stephen.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, that's the benefit, I think, of memes and TikTok.
And The Simpsons. And,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, they do serve a secondary purpose other than just, like, you know, immediate motivation. But the great thing is, I think, about Sunset Boulevard and the coincidence of it is that it was released smack dab in the middle of the 20th century. And the 20th century is remembered for many, many different things, some of them really, really atrocious. But it's the century of entertainment, really. And Hollywood was the epicenter of all that entertainment. I mean, in 1950, 90, for every dollar spent on entertainment in the United States, 90 cents went to Hollywood. That's how big movies were. And what happened was, if you can think about, you know, the movies as this beautiful, crystal clear, silvery, smooth lake, and Sunset Boulevard drops into the middle of it and it ripples out. And that's how much of a disruptor it was, because Hollywood has never been the same since, and movies about movie making have never been the same since. As you said, it pulled back the curtain and you see, oh my Lord, what is the industry like and the people who actually go to make these silver dreams on the screen?
Well, maybe for anybody who's listening and may not have seen Sunset Boulevard, and if you haven't, you're in for an extraordinary treat over the course of the next few days or the weekend or whenever you choose to do it.
Yeah.
Tell us the story of the film.
Okay, well, it begins with Joe Gillis. He's a struggling screenwriter, and the car owners are looking to repossess his car. And so he races away from them. He has a blowout on the tire. He swerves up in the canyon, up into a driveway, hides the car in the garage, and then goes to investigate this house. And he finds in this house this reclusive old lady who seems to be in a state of grief because somebody in the house has died. And then we discover that the death was her chimp, her monkey. And they're about to have a funeral for the monkey. And that's how bizarre it is at the beginning. And it gets more and more strange. I mean, we are no longer in Kansas, if to quote from another great Hollywood picture. And so what happens is Joe Gillis discovers that the lady's name is Norma Desmond. As you said, she's a reclusive former film star. And she now senses the possibility that she could relaunch her career. And he is, as I said, is a struggling screenwriter. And these two very strange people then come together. He's looking for a job. She's looking for a rebirth of her career. So
what could possibly go wrong?
Well, plenty of things. And there's a great hint at the beginning of the movie The way the film starts, the opening image is of a curb in Hollywood. And it announces not only the name of the movie, Sunset Boulevard, but names the street. But if you look, if you examine the picture closely, you're staring at the gutter. And that's where the movie starts. And within 2 minutes, I'm not only giving any spoiler here, you've got a corpse in a swimming pool.
I think after 75 years, I think the spoiler alert goes out the window on Sunset Boulevard, I think.
Yeah. So that's the tone. It sets the tone from the very, very beginning. And just as a quick aside, the original draft of the screenplay that Billy Wilder wrote with his partner, Charles Brackett, began in a morgue, and the body of Joe Gillis is wheeled in, and he sits up and he starts to talk to the other corpses, and they shot it and they test previewed the movie, and the audience thought it was supposed to be a comedy. Yeah. And they laughed so uproariously at that, everything else died in the rest of the picture, so they had to take that out and just reimagine the beginning of the story. And that's why we open up on the curb in the gutter,
which is tonally radically different. Okay, tell me, for those people who may not know about him, about the great Billy Wilder, about his work, about his career.
Okay, he was born in Vienna in 1902 to a Jewish family, so he's Austrian by birth. With the rise of the Nazis coming to power in the 1930s, he fled to the United States. And then tragically, it was at the end of the war in 1945 that he discovered that his grandmother, his mother and his stepfather had all been murdered at Auschwitz. But in terms of his movie career, it is very hard to find anybody in the history of Hollywood who could equal what he achieved. He won 7 Oscars, was nominated for another 14. He won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. He won BAFTAs. He won Golden Globes. He won the Writers Guild of America 7 times. He won the Directors Guild of America. His filmography includes Double Indemnity, Some Like It Hot, The 7-Year Itch, The Apartment, Stalag 17, Ace in the Hole. Very, very few people can come near what Billy Wilder delivered.
Ace in the Hole, which I think is a wildly underrated film out of Billy Wilder's oeuvre for those of you who haven't seen it.
And again, you know, you have in that movie, you've got Kirk Douglas as this down at heel, absolutely ruthless yellow tabloid journalist. And to show how low he goes into a mining pit to find a story. And then instead of helping rescue the man, he makes sure that he stays there to milk it.
I think there's a whole other discussion about Ace in the Hole, which we might come back to at some point. We're used to films about Hollywood now, and certainly, you know, the 80s, 90s onwards, right up to things like Seth Rogen's The Studio now. If people have seen that on Apple Plus. I mean, I'm thinking of films like The Player. I'm thinking about Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, David Lynch.
But it was quite an extraordinary thing at the time to lift the veil on that world and to bring Gloria Swanson out of retirement and to play on that idea of aging, glamour, maybe those people who hadn't necessarily survived that transition from silent cinema to talkies.
Yeah, there were quite a number of actors and actresses who didn't survive the transition because they looked fantastic on screen. They were great charisma, John Gilbert, for example, or Pola Negri. But when the talkies came along, they'd have to open their mouth. And as Norman Desmond says, they had to open their mouth and talk. And then you heard their accents. And Pola Negri was a Polish actress, and she was never able to shake the Polish accent, so her career withered on the vine. But just to correct some misperception that fans of the film may have, Gloria Swanson actually wasn't anything like the character that she played in the movie. A myth has grown up that she was just like Norman Desmond. She wasn't. Yes, her film career had declined, but she had reinvented herself as a theatre actress, and by 1948 she actually had her own TV show, so she was very successful. And then it was Billy Wilder who approached her with the project, and she said she would do it on one condition. She wasn't going to do a screen test. You either want me and take me or not at all. But, you know, there was other movies prior to the arrival of Sunset Boulevard, all about the filmmaking in Hollywood. And they were all pretty much affectionate. They're all about the rise to stardom. And none of them dared to criticise the royal court or... They were paying more homage to the emperor in Hollywood. But when Billy Wilder and Charles Brackett delivered the movie, I call it a shot of espresso laced with enough arsenic to kill a horse. And that's really what they delivered. And as I said, Hollywood is yet to recover.
What did Hollywood make of it at the time then? How did it fare in terms of what other studio heads made of it at Oscar time? What happened?
The movie was made in Paramount Pictures, but when the head of MGM, a rival studio, Louis B. Mayer, saw it, he demanded that the print be burned. Thankfully, though, other people liked it. The Academy adored the film. It was nominated for 11 Oscars, including Best Picture, including Director for Billy Wilder and Best Screenplay, but also Gloria Swanson. And unfortunately, that year, it had the misfortune to come up against All About Eve. Now, All About Eve is a very fine picture, but I think Sunset Boulevard nudges it. I think All About Eve has great theatrical performances, but its delivery is terribly arch. And visually, it's very, very dull. It's very, very flat. But if you compare Sunset Boulevard to it, Sunset Boulevard is very strongly informed by the film noir style. Deep shadows, extreme close-ups, deep focus as well in certain shots. This old cavernous house. It's like a ghost story paying reference to Great Expectations. Now, unfortunately, Gloria Swanson did not win the Oscar that year. She lost out to Judy Holliday. And she appeared for her comedic performance in a movie called Born Yesterday. Now, I mentioned that for two reasons. Her co-star in Born Yesterday was William Holden. And Born Yesterday was directed by George Cukor. And it was George Cukor who told Billy Wilder, you know, Billy, you should cast Gloria Swanson in the movie. So there we go.
We're going to hear from the glorious Gloria Swanson. You might have known her as she was, her previous incarnation as a young, beautiful, untouchable silent star. But here she is in a TV interview in 1957. She's talking about acting, about casting, and about the important thing of aging in Hollywood.
Are you through with Hollywood, or is it the other way around?
No, I would love to do pictures. But you see, pictures are so changed, but so is life. And sometimes people find it difficult to go along with changes. I find it rather difficult because I'm one of the people that believes in romance. And I don't think that that has any age. And somehow in Hollywood, it does have. You will notice that all the old boys, all the old stars are still there, though they may wear toupees.
And the girls?
Oh, the girls are rather young and attractive and about sometimes 30 years younger. And when I went around the country for Sunset Boulevard and another picture which I liked very much, The Heiress, I talked to the women who I really believe were responsible for making motion pictures successful, because it was Mary who took John to the picture show. And she had to like that gal up there. She had to identify herself with the woman that was playing the part. Mm-hmm. Well, she goes to the picture shows now. He identifies himself with Gable, but opposite Gable, or the rest of them, Cooper, is some young thing that could be her granddaughter or daughter, so she doesn't find herself there at all.
No sense of identification.
No.
That's, you were just saying to me off air that's the great Mike Wallace, the television
interviewer. That's correct,
interviewer.
Yeah, Mike Wallace, who then was portrayed by Christopher Plummer in The Insider.
Yeah.
Yeah, TV show 60 Minutes.
What kind of actress is she in this film? Because obviously she is a formerly silent actress herself, yeah, who is playing a formerly silent actress who never managed to make the transition to talkies. Mm. And yet obviously her role in this and her performance is incredible.
It is. And what I find quite amazing about it is it's a lovely mixture that's counterpointed by William Holden. William Holden's character is laconic, dry tone of humour, and it's almost minimalist acting. And then if you look at Gloria Swanson, it is so big and it is so silent. Those eyes are like, you know, Klieg lights. And it's a very, very mannered performance. And it was really, really well measured by both actors and the director, because they both complement each other. And, you know, the funny thing is, Rick, that originally Billy Wilder wanted to cast Montgomery Clift. And that would have been a disaster.
It would have been a very different film.
Yeah, it would have been. And I don't think it would have worked, because Montgomery Clift, I've very rarely seen an actor so tormented and tortured from the 1940s and 1950s. Mm. And he wouldn't have been able to deliver the dry humour that the role required to counterpoint the sort of the madness of Norma Desmond. And because of that, you know, when you see William Holden's performance and Gloria Swanson's performance, the two of them are actually like twin engines, because they're really depicting the undercurrent, the underbelly of what drives Hollywood, which is desire and despair. Okay, these are the two things. And when you watch Sunset Boulevard, if anybody hasn't watched for the first time is listening, if they watch the movie with those two emotions in mind, they inform every single scene, sometimes both at the same time. And then you see what drives these two characters quite mad.
Well, what we're going to do is take a clip from Billy Wilder himself. This is him talking about his original idea for the film.
I was very much taken by the original Stars Born picture of Mr. Selznick. And I said, my God, one day I should do a Hollywood picture. It's going to be interesting. And first I was fooling around I have my notes someplace, the early notes, like 35 years ago. I said, a comedy of an actress who fallen between the cracks when, with the advent of sound. She just, the voice does not work. She is out of the business, would like to come back. And I thought of it as a comedy, and I wanted to make it with Mae West, believe it or not, you know. And then I forgot about it, and I made some other pictures. And then one day I stuck that out, and there are some pretty good scenes, but I don't think it should be a comedy. And I kind of had a vague, vague outline with similarity to it. And Brackett liked it as well. We started writing, and it was very difficult. It was very difficult because if you make a picture that plays at the dentist convention in Albany, you know, they will believe it. They don't know how. It's too easy, too. But in any case, after it was finished, Mr. Louis B. Mayer, having seen that at the showing at Paramount, I heard him talking to his henchmen, their whole group of Louis B. Mayer people. He says, that son of a bitch Wilder, he says, he's a foreigner, he says. We let him in. We gave him a life. We gave him a family. And now he's biting the hand that's been feeding him.
And he was like so many filmmakers of his time and of that era. He was writing screenplays in a second language. English wasn't his first language.
Yeah, and that's quite amazing. And sometimes you can hear sort of a Central European Yiddish idiom drifting through. There's a scene early on in the movie when William Holden, when Joe Gillis first arrives at the house, and he references Great Expectations, and he says, when Miss Havisham was given the go-by. That's not a phrase that we have in English, but you can almost hear sort of the Austrian, the Viennese, or the Yiddish phraseology running through that. And you hear it again in Double Indemnity. You hear it again in Some Like It Hot. So, you know, it is quite an achievement to remember that it wasn't his first language, but yet his phrases, some of the lines, nobody's perfect, have now become common phrases in the English language. So it's quite an amazing achievement for it. If he's not writing in his first language, and then this is what he delivers to us.
Did you ever see the musical version?
No.
I didn't either. And I think I avoided it specifically because I couldn't see it being brought to life. Although obviously hugely successful, really well in the UK. It's just finished a run on Broadway where it won Tony's.
A revival, right.
Yeah. And I know, I don't think I could bring myself to see it. I think I was perfectly happy to leave.
Yeah, so was I.
It's been lovely to talk to you, Stephen Bennett.
Great.
Thank you for talking to us about Sunset Boulevard and the 75th anniversary this evening here on Arena. Jennifer Walsh's groundbreaking opera Mars, commissioned by Irish National Opera, premiered at the Galway International Arts Festival this weekend. Set in a rocket's command module, it follows four astronauts as they navigate humanity's future and a tech billionaire's takeover. With a libretto by Mark O'Connell, Walsh's eclectic score and Tom Creed's co-direction, they create a dynamic blend of satire, poignancy and immersive visuals, brought to life by a stellar cast and innovative design. Michael Dungan was at the premiere and he joins me in studio now. Michael, four female astronauts travelling to Mars, hoping to preserve the human race. We're in a spaceship. You have the fantastically named tech bro, Axel Parchment. Tell us a little more about Mars.
Four female astronauts in a command capsule or a command module. And it's not parody. It's not goofy. There's tremendous attention to detail. The set and the interior of the module looks like what we would all expect a module to look like from the films that we've seen, Apollo 13 and the like. There is humor in the telling of the story, but not in the set or in the design and costuming. The costumes are amazing, helmets and spacesuits, and they look and act like the real deal.
Maybe start with Jennifer Walsh's score and we can work our way up from there. She's best known for unusual, unorthodox themes, her Barbie opera, XXX Live, Nude Girls. Tell us a little bit about her and her work and then about this.
She just seems to have a brain with a massive capacity to grab hold of ideas, disparate ones, focused ones, and bring them all together. And then in this opera, she wants to say everything that she can. So it's very, very rich. It's very dense. I'm going again so I can catch more of what I saw on Friday.
You'd said that to me earlier, that it's the sort of thing that possibly benefits from a second watch and from a second listen. Mm. Why is that?
Because the shifts between the different ideas and between the different ways that the characters express them are rapid. At one moment you can be laughing, and another moment it becomes more serious, or both at the same time, as she's being satirical, as she is, about AI, which she also uses in her work. It's both funny and critical at the same time, and deadly serious.
I may be getting slightly ahead of myself here. Tell me about the arc of the story, and tell me about where we are when the story begins and how our characters find themselves on this mission.
There are four scientists, come astronauts, and we meet them as they prepare to board. It's very the right stuff. And they board, and there's a whole liftoff procedure. The movement director, Brian Burrows, has prepared them extremely well so that they manage to sing and vibrate with the great power of the rocket at the same time for minutes upon minutes upon minutes. It's quite impressive. Then when they hit zero gravity, he has them also trained to replicate movement in zero gravity, and it's, again, it's not a parody, it's not funny, it's just done very, very well.
And about the libretto, people may know Mark O'Connell's name either through his columns in the Irish Times, or they may have read A Thread of Violence a couple of years ago, but particularly To Be a Machine, possibly his book on transhumanism might be more relevant when it comes to his libretto here. Talk to me about that.
They must have found each other through that, and through, I think he also, I don't know if it was in To Be a Machine or in something later, that he did write about Mars colonization. And around the early COVID was around the time that Jennifer Walsh went into a deep dive on all of this, and they began to meet and exchange ideas on that.
You talked a little bit about Brian Burrows' work here. Maybe delve a little bit into as to how he has managed to create this world on stage, because I can imagine at the best of times trying to have actors move in a space that some way simulates being on board a spacecraft is hard, but having to do it with opera singers who are attempting to use their voices at the same time. I've no sense of how that would, how you begin to do that.
Neither have I. Something that aids it is there are live cameras. Well, I think they're live. Somebody else who was at the performance was asking me, did I think they were live? Or Jennifer Walsh, with her attention to detail, perhaps pre-recorded and to simulate live. But there are screens supposedly showing what the live cameras inside the capsule show. And you're watching both of these things. And as the screens, the angle of the cameras tilt a little bit, and that's all it takes to make you think these people are floating. But their movements, the way they use their limbs and their hair, really does convey the sense that they have hit weightlessness.
There are huge, huge, huge themes at play here, though, throughout the course of the opera. Tell us about those.
Competing themes. And there are very personal ones that are typical for opera, things to do with things like loss and longing. We have camaraderie as well here. But the bigger themes that maybe you're referring to are things like AI and the whole notion of colonization. And is it right? Is it right for us to make a mess here on our own planet and then say, well, we will save ourselves by going to another one? And will we not just bring all our problems with us to that one and create the same problems there?
The AI thing probably interests a lot of people, and their ears may have pricked up, because you're right, she does use AI in some of her work in this, while at the same time making it a theme of that. How does that work for you?
In this case, the chief villain is the tech pro billionaire named Axel. You have it there.
Axel Parchment.
Axel Parchment is right. We don't. His face is created with AI and superimposed on the screen onto one or other of the singers, We see they sing his words, but the face is his, and it's goofy, and it's accompanied by music, which Jennifer Walsh generated using AI, and it's kind of, it's electronic dance music, crappy electronic dance music.
You were there at the premiere, and you had said that Tom Creed was talking about the co-directing and about how much he had enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, he's a leading director. He does a huge amount of work on the Irish stage and with Irish National Opera. And here he was sharing the platform with Jennifer Walsh and just openly admiring her and saying how inspiring it was to sit with her for 7 hours a day, going over different ideas and different aspects of movement and so on.
Playing alongside everything that we've talked about so far as the INO's orchestra, their role is probably a little different here than it would be in another production. Tell us about that and about the kind of impact it has.
It's an orchestra, but it's quite small, one to a part. Apart from percussion, there are two percussionists, and they are all on stage. So we can see them. They are behind a screen, which sometimes blots them out, depending on the imagery that's used. But other times they are quite visible, and they are busy. The double bass player has balloons attached to his bow, which they calculated to recreate what would 38% gravity be like for a double bass player playing on Mars. The two percussionists are very, very busy. They have to be able to operate a microscope so we can examine something that might be a life form on Mars once they land. And they sing and they stand up, and from time to time, they are very much part of the performance.
I think this is something I will enjoy very much, and I've already gone and bought tickets off the back of your review. But is it something that people might find distracting, possibly, if they're not expecting it?
Distracting. Hopefully, you'd be as in
visually distracting.
Yeah, I remember thinking at the very beginning and expecting something because it was Jennifer Walsh. I wonder, is it going to be a three ring circus? But it isn't in the end. You do have to stay very alert in order to keep up. But everything that happens is so engaging. That no, I don't think distracting would be a word that I would use.
How do you think it went down with the audience in Galway at the Arts Festival? There's a lot to process by the sounds of it.
There was, and I reckon about three quarters of them stayed behind to hear a brief talk or interview on stage with Jennifer Walsh, Mark O'Connell and Tom Creed. So I think everybody was still processing what they had heard. And it was very interesting to hear what they had to say about it and about the process and how the three of them worked together. Mark O'Connell in particular, this was a first foray for him into anything other than nonfiction. So he found himself writing fiction and for an opera.
It is, and it's the thing that maybe interests me most about it and the thing that piqued my curiosity at the time. Do you think that he's been successful in this? Do you think that this is something you can see him doing again?
I hope so. I hope so. There is a very quiet moment when they're pondering the puniness of humanity, and one is reflecting on a voice saying to her, "You are nothing, but so is everything else." Which, you know, we think of all the large things in our galaxies and in our universe, but they are, in the big scheme of things, they are also nothing. So,
It is coming to the Abbey Theatre next week. Do you think that Mars might, if you'll pardon the pun, travel further than that? Do you think it's the sort of thing that might become a stable in the opera repertoire?
I hope so. Or stable, maybe not. That is a different question because it's very much a snapshot of our times. And the issues of our time. Some of the issues are more universal, but things like the question of Martian global colonization and the use and the invasiveness of AI. Perhaps in 20 years they will be less issues than they are now.
I saw a particularly warm article about it in the New York Times today. Do you think that might influence its possible future?
That would be good. I think the US would be a great place for this to go.
Okay, in 25 words or less, although I know pretty much where this is going, would you recommend this? Is this the sort of production that people should seek out?
I have recommended it. My wife was with me, and I recommended it to her sister, who is not really an opera goer. I struck it lucky with her once. I said, go to this, and she went, and she loved it. She went to this, and she also loved it. Now, that's a non-expert, but very enthusiastic response.
And my thanks to Michael Dungan for his review of the Irish National Opera's Mars in Galway. It'll be at the Abbey Theatre from Thursday, August 7th until Saturday, August 9th. It's only 3 nights, so make sure to catch it while you can. And further information is at abbeytheatre.ie. That's it for me for tonight. The programme was produced by Sian O'Gorman. Research was by Paula Shields. Broadcast coordinators Ollie Hamilton and sound supervision tonight by James Feeney. I'll be here tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. In for Sean, John Creedon is next here on RTE Radio 1. Have a good evening and I'll see you tomorrow.